Support for KBOO comes from our listeners. If you value independent media, go to kboo.fm and click donate. And thank you for supporting your community radio station.
Participate in this event.
This celebration will also feature lots of live music and entertainment. Celebrate our planet at the 2014 Earth Day Celebration, Saturday, April 26th, from 10 a.m. to 6 p.m. at Kenton Park. More information on this event can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
This is KBOO Portland. The time is 11 a.m. Coming up on the Radio Zine, host Lisa Loving speaks with Ariel Gore about her new book, The End of Eve. Later, we'll hear an interview with noted gay author Edmund White, who discusses his latest memoir, Inside a Pearl, about his life in Paris. Thanks, KBOO members, for your generous support. If you are not a member, you can repair that by going to kboo.fm and click where it says Donate Today.
I am Lisa Loving. We're here today with Ariel Gore. Ariel, thanks for being with us.
Thanks for having me.
This is a big year for you. This is a very big year.
Yes.
You relaunched Hip Mama.
I did.
And this book, The End of Eve, it's your new memoir about your mom, the death of your mom. Ariel, I think this is going to be your biggest book so far out of quite a few. I'm just saying, after 25 years, you're going to be an overnight success.
Okay, that's great. I'm ready for that. I'm ready for my overnight stardom.
Ready for your close-up. And of course, Hip Mama was that was the first zine I'd ever heard of in my life.
Oh, really?
I'd never heard the
that's
term.
Great.
And so that was in the 1990s you started that?
Yes, 20 years ago. So the relaunch issue that I just put out is actually also the 20th anniversary issue. I started it as my senior project at Mills College, and the first issue came out in December 93, actually.
And that's why we often think of you, we just associate you with family and motherhood, but alternate momhood, really, not necessarily Leave It to Beaver motherhood, although there might have been some interesting stuff going on there if we knew what was really happening. But we do associate you with motherhood, and that's why this book, The End of Eve, about your mom and you and your family, it's so, I feel like it's more personal than other things you've written in the past. It's a dangerous book.
I think it's definitely my most vulnerable book. It's about, certainly also about caregiving. I've always written about parenting. And so this is about taking care of my mom when she was sick and when she was dying. And just my relationship with my mom in general, which certainly has informed my parenting in a lot of different ways and informed my writing about parenting and wanting to write about parenting and wanting to be a support to moms who are having a hard time.
And all kinds of moms with tattoos. You were the first mom I ever saw with great big old tattoos as
really?
Well.
Really? Yeah. Wow. Okay. I'm glad that I could open that up for you.
Thank you. No, but this book, The End of Eve, talk about your mother. Your mother and your dad were completely unique people. Your father had left the Roman Catholic Church as a priest to marry your mother. Can you just fill us in on your mom?
Yes. My mom was beautiful. That's the first thing everyone noticed about her. Quite alluring. She's... people were drawn to her, and she was completely out of her mind. She was super abusive. She kind of dramatically seduced my stepdad, who was a Roman Catholic priest. He was excommunicated when they got married. She worked at San Quentin on death row when I was a kid. She was always, sort of longing to do things that were larger than life and kind of dramatic. She was, she's from Beverly Hills. She, I think in another time without quite so many mental health problems, she would have wanted to be, a movie star or just something, very Hollywood. So that was kind of her personality. So she was, she's difficult all my life. So, when, I was taking care of her when she started to get sick, that kind of drama and larger than life persona certainly didn't go away, and her meanness didn't go away.
And but see, that's one of the things, again, that gets me about this book in particular, is that so much of life is about opposites. We have love-hate relationships with all kinds of things all around us, even just life itself. Sometimes we have a love-hate relationship with life. And it really kind of is about the love-hate relationship you had with your mom. And yet there's moments of beauty in there and moments of fear. There's fear in there, I think, somehow. And it just, I just wondered if you could talk a little bit about how do you take a story like that but make it into something that's a universal story? Because as I'm reading through this book, I can feel my own family history as well. I mean, it's an amazing story. It's in so many ways a unique story, but there's aspects of it that are universal. And can you talk about that a little bit? I mean, I can see by your face that you're like, I'm not sure if that's what I think about it, but that is part of what a memoir is. It shows change in you, but also it's like people can identify with some parts of this in ways that are shocking.
Oh, I think so. And I hope that, you know, the sort of deeper you dig into your personal story and truth, the closer you get to a kind of universal stream. So I think that just has to do with being super honest. And, you know, when I was writing it, I'd tell people, oh, yeah, I'm writing a book about my mom when she's dying of lung cancer. And they would kind of go all doe-eyed. And I'd be like, no, it's a comedy about domestic violence. And they would sort of nervously laugh. It was sort of hard for me to come up with the, you know, in a nutshell, what are you doing, Ariel? And so it's sort of just been out in the world for a little bit now. And I'm, you know, super thrilled that it's, you know, it's making people laugh. It's it is the dark humor of the whole situation. Did kind of come through, and that was important to me in the book, not just because I, you know, you don't want to be overwrought or a downer. I think it's fine to be those things. But, you know, my family was very violent. My mom in particular was the source of that violence. There's a lot of humor in my family too. Like, that's the way that we dealt with the tension of crazy situations. You know, sometimes making my mom laugh was, you know, literally the only way to get her to put down her weapon. And so it was really the coping mechanism in our family. And it was important to me to kind of capture that. And, you know, obviously I don't think domestic violence is a joke. You know, we all know too much about family violence. But I think it, in a lot of families, it is closely associated with a really kind of dark humor.
Mm. And we are speaking with Ariel Gore, her newest book, a memoir, The End of Eve. And you've written so many books. I remember when you first started putting some of these anthologies together of writing from Hip Mama, and you've done quite a few of, you've written a couple of memoirs just digging into quirky histories, unique histories of your life. One of the things that fascinates me the most about this book, though, is that sometimes in my mind, it's kind of like your life trajectory is, it's like, how would I say this? Right now, it's the end of the baby boom generation, okay? So your mother, you know, older woman, and you're literally the unwilling caregiver. And yet that's so complicated, but there's so many people now that have to be their parents' caregiver, and people don't know how to do that. And I know so many people that have to. People whose parents are suffering with Alzheimer's disease, can be really painful. And I know someone who's having to deal with that with her mother right now too. And I think that that's part of it. You started your career, when I first met you, blazing a trail and understanding single momhood. And it was a scary thing, and you held up a light, and now you still have that light, and you're sort of holding it up and showing kind of the end of that journey in a way. I mean, can you talk about that a little bit, connecting your earlier career when you were writing about the stigma people attached to single moms, and now you've traveled that journey of your life, right? And showing almost the retrogenesis of having to be the caregiver of an elderly person who's even abusive, an adult. Can you talk about that, the trajectory?
Well, I mean, when I agreed to try to take care of my mom's, a lot of my friends thought I was codependent or, you know, wanted to label it in some kind of unwell way. And I completely I'm 100% behind people who choose not to do that. You know, if you have an abusive parent or even you're just, you know, that's not your path. You're not going to take care of your parent when they're dying or older. I'm all for that also. I don't think there's any right choice. But for me, it was the right thing to do. And something like, you know, at any time, 30% of the U.S. population is working as unpaid caregivers for a disabled or ill or dying relative. There was a recent survey where, you know, sort of our generation, my generation, really want to take care of their parents as they get older. Certainly, like healthcare options make it so that, you know, there aren't as many sort of, you know, let's put mom in a nursing home option. We certainly didn't have that option with my mom. So for reasons both practical and just, you know, family-oriented preferences, people are wanting to take care of their parents. And then that same survey that said, you know, most of us do want to do it, it was like, you know, nobody has a plan. so it's interesting. We find ourselves in this place where, you know, a lot of us kind of feel like it's the right thing. We're kind of up for it. But the, you know, the healthcare resources aren't there and we don't have a plan. We don't know, what that's going to look like.
Same thing back in the 90s when you were having your first kid.
Right.
You were going out
there.
What
is the plan?
I want to ask you something weird, though.
Okay.
When you first started doing Hip Mama, right, and now knowing more about the family background you were really coming out of, which I didn't know that at the time at all, do you feel as though part of the work you were doing with Hip Mama and with your kids trying to make it right, trying to sort of rewrite your mind and rewrite what you knew family should be?
Well, you know, when I had my first kid when I was 19, I had my daughter, Maya, and I was terrified that I was going to abuse her, and I was terrified that I was going to torment her. I learned from my mom in particular, not from my dad so much, but I learned from my mom that being a mom was really hard and that it was really hard not to kind of lash out at your kids. And so I think I needed support and I needed not necessarily advice so much as support and a little bit of guidance and reassurance and feeling like I had maybe a little bit of community that I could reach out to if that was my experience. I mean, it turned out my experience was that it's not that hard not to abuse your kids. It's not that hard not to be jealous of your kids. I mean, that might just be a personality type on my part. You know, not that I was always the perfect mom and that I was always completely nonviolent, but I found that it wasn't, you know, it wasn't like this big struggle to not abuse my kids. You know, my mom made it look like, oh, you know, I have to treat you like this way because it's, you know, it's so trying to have children.
Because it's normal. Is that what the sense was? Was your mom basically kind of saying, the way it is. This is the way it always is.
Yeah. I mean, she grew up in a very violent household. Her dad was in World War II and was not there for the first 7 years of her life, and then came home with terrible PTSD and brought that, like so many families of that time, brought that war home to his family. And so she grew up in a violent household, like, you know, so who knows for how many generations. But sure. And there's, you know, there's also this, I learned to, you know, as I was raising my daughter, I did feel like if we couldn't tell the truth about what it was like to be a parent, then maybe a certain kind of family violence is inevitable. I mean, there's a certain pressure cooker thing that happens there when you have to pretend to be the perfect family. So that was another thing with Hit Mama that it was important to me to tell the truth about what was imperfect and what was really hard. And I think that made parenting a lot easier for me, just to not have to lie about it and to have a place, you know, in my case, a publication, but also, you know, any kind of community where you can tell the truth about what's going on. It just, you know, makes you less needing to, you know, punch walls or people.
I remember in the first years, you would always have a Martha Stewart style calendar inside the cover of Hit Mama, but it was the wrong Martha Stewart. You know, I have a thing for Martha Stewart. But it would be like, well, I'm not going to get into it, but I think people can probably find copies of that maybe if they look for it. I really recommend that people do. But the other thing, right, and of course and here it is back, you brought the day book back.
I did.
In the current edition.
You can't have Hit Mama without the day book.
The day book, which is your calendar. One of the other threads of the end of Eve is the breakup of, I believe, your long-term relationship with your sweetheart.
Mm-hmm.
So that happened while you were doing the caregiver thing. It all happened at once?
Yes. My whole life exploded. Well, you know, we were living here in Portland. Myself, my partner, our then toddler kid, my older daughter had just gone off to college. And when my mom was diagnosed with stage 4 lung cancer, we agreed to move to New Mexico and get a big house with her. It was a duplex when we bought it. And of course, my mother got there first and had it gutted. But our idea was that we were going to go live in a duplex with her and have somewhat separate dwellings. But anyway, when we got there, it wasn't a duplex and it also wasn't inhabitable. So, you know, it certainly put a lot of pressure on my relationship to be, you know, there taking care of my mom. And, you know, it was completely insane in so many ways. And, you know, it's all for the best in the end. That relationship was probably circling the drain anyway. But even if it hadn't been, I don't know if it could have survived that level of sort of upheaval. And my now ex-partner's, you know, her father ended up dying before my mom even did. And there we were, you know, focusing on my mom, taking care of my mom, who was supposed to, you know, have this imminently terminal thing going on. So it was all life, you know. This is what happens, people.
What John Lennon said, chaos. Life is what happens when you're busy planning for other things. We are speaking with Ariel Gore, her newest book, The End of Eve. It's a memoir of, I'm going to say, the last year of your mother's life and how you, and all the things that happened around that. I think, too, what you were just talking about also goes to the universality. You know, we all, especially when you get to be a certain age and you look at your parents, if you're connected to your parents, some people are not, but you wonder what's going to happen with them. And the difficulty of the caregiving and stuff like that, you wonder, like, it's like a precipice. And again, I feel as though you kind of flew out there with a lantern to show people some of the pitfalls and some of the things to possibly expect, right, or maybe not. And that's an amazing thing that you did there. But I wanted to, the other thing that I wanted to ask you about was, though, just the sense of how dreamlike some of the language is. I mean, I think this book is different from all the other books you wrote. I just do. I think that it feels different. It sounds different. The words are different. And I wondered if you, I know that you started writing it at least almost as soon as your mother passed away. I mean, you didn't wait 10 years and then write the book. You. When did you start writing it?
I started writing it about 2 weeks after my mom died. I was not writing almost anything the time that I was taking care of her, you know, consumed as I was taking care of her and, you know, the breadwinner for my family also. So I was really focused on survival and the logistics of life. So it wasn't, you know, just besides maybe a few pages of kind of unconnected notes, I didn't write when she was 11. And then as soon as she passed, I really started to notice almost immediately that I was kind of cleaning up my memories and being like, well, you know, it wasn't that bad. And it that part couldn't have happened.
Even
certainly.
As you were cleaning out the house.
Exactly. And so I thought, you know, I've got to get to work recording this in at least something close to real time so that I don't sugarcoat it, so that I don't, you know, end up telling people, oh, you know, it wasn't so bad. Death is beautiful. You know, there was some end of life, you know, love and light, sweetness, all the sort of myth that our culture tells us about death, that our family dysfunctions are somehow going to go away, that we're going to, that people kind of, you know, and some people, sure, some people do get sweeter, especially if they have memory problems. You know, my mom never got sweeter. The dysfunctions never went away. When she was, you know, finally bedridden, she was less scary, you know, physically. But, you know, even a few weeks before she passed, I remember calling my new girlfriend and just crying and being like, I agreed to come back here because I thought she couldn't hurt me anymore. And that's, you know, it had its strange beauty, but it was very ugly in many ways to the end. And I wanted to capture that and be able to tell the truth about that and be able to tell the truth about what death looks like sometimes.
One of the things that strikes me is because I followed some of this on social media as well, like we're connected on this Facebook, and you wrote about some of it as it happened, like some things that happened as you were cleaning up your mom's house, like finding whiskey bottles in the file cabinets and stuff like that. And I remember this one point too where the doctors had said that your mother was going to pass away, and you went there and she kind of sat up and said, I'd really like an omelet now. Just that whole
yeah,
uncertainty.
Yeah, she said it a little more vulgar than that, but we can't say what she said on the radio.
But do you think that part of the reason that we spin all these rainbows and unicorns about death is that we're sometimes I think everything that we do in life is trying to cope with the fact that we're all going to die. I mean, do you have that sense? I mean, did you intrude your own thoughts about what's going to happen when you die somehow as you were thinking about what you wanted to do for your mother? Like maybe you're hoping someone will do that for you.
Sure. I mean, it's interesting because it, you know, I talk about, you know, nobody has a plan for how they're going to take care of their elders. But the trick is that you can't plan. You could, you know, you could build a little in-law unit in your backyard, and then it could turn out that your elders need assisted living, or, you know, you could plan for a sort of cancer scenario and you get an Alzheimer's scenario. My grandma died just a few weeks before my mom was diagnosed, and she was living independently, and she got up in the middle of the night to get herself a glass of whiskey and she fell over, you know, and that's what I'm shooting for, that scenario. But you certainly think about your own mortality. I mean, I went from being a granddaughter and a daughter to being, you know, the sort of matriarch of my family in a very short period of time. So, you know, you do think about it and suddenly realize I'm so angry at all these people for not having a will, and do I have a will, you know?
Right. That's the other thing I wanted to ask you about, because I remember you did, that was a sudden realization for you. And what does it mean? How do you feel about that now? I mean, what does it mean to be la encargada, you know, of your unit? What changed for you when that happened? Did you have to like clean up the kitchen more? What was it?
Well, it's frankly, since my mom passed, I've been happily relieved. I have a lot less anxiety in the world. I think having the legacy for me, having a super critical mom, is that I kind of went around in my life thinking that, you know, everyone was looking at me and anyone cared whether or not I was, you know, had any shoes on. And, you know, you feel very self-conscious, like the horrible thing that the world revolves around. And, you know, if I was maybe a more evolved person, my mom wouldn't have to die for me to get over that. But as it turned out, it's been a great sort of psychological relief. So, you know, being the sort of elder in my family now, It does. It's comfortable. I don't dislike it. I mean, I am sort of anxious about getting grandchildren. I want my children to breed early and often, but I guess they can take their time too if they need to.
We're talking with Ariel Gore. We're talking about her newest book, The End of Eve. We already talked a little bit about the relaunch of Hip Mama magazine, which is exciting, based in Berkeley, right? I want to stop for a minute and say, what is it, though, that you hope people take from this book and the work that you're doing this year around family? You're rekindling the magazine, which is, it's an outreach. It's a safety zone for talking about things that we are afraid to admit sometimes. What's the most important thing that you want people to take away from this work that you're doing this year?
Well, I mean, I want there to be more truth-telling when it comes to caregiving. I think that caregiving is at once kind of devalued, and you're a saint if you do it. And, you know, it's like the single mom thing. Like, you are the most hated, and you are a saint. And there's no room for your humanity in either of those archetypes. And I felt the same way about taking care of my mom when she was getting sick, that it was certainly unpaid. The work that I was doing was very much culturally devalued. And then every once in a while, people would get sparkly on Facebook and be sending love and light. And there was this sense like, oh, you know, and people would say it literally, you're a saint. And so how do you tell the truth about what you're doing if those are kind of the options? So I think that's what the work has in common, and also what I want people to have more kind of open or free dialogue about, that this is real hard soul work, and the people doing it are mostly human and messy ourselves, and, you know,
maybe guys can do it too.
Certainly. yes. You know, there were certainly times when I wanted to rip all the tubes out of my mom's body and watch her die in slow agony. And I think it's important to be able to say that and also not do that. Also just be like, okay, I've got to go now. I'm not feeling really bright today.
We just have like about a minute left. We're with Ariel Gore on KBOO Portland. Ariel, where can people go to read more of your work right now? HipMama.com?
HipMamaZine.com. You can find the zine there. ArielGore.com. You can find everything that I do online.
And you're writing for a lot more publications too.
All the local bookstores should that are still alive are wonderful and should be able to help everybody out finding the zine and books.
All right. And all right, I just want to thank you for being with us today. Ariel Gore, her newest book, The End of Eve. Of course, Atlas of the Human Heart, another book, another memoir that she wrote a few years ago. I'm calling this The End of Eve. This is going to be one of the books of the year. Just calling it. All right. Thank you for being here.
Thank you.
And I'm Lisa Loving for Between the Covers.
That was Lisa Loving speaking with Ariel Gore. Coming up next, we hear Edmund White discussing his latest memoir, Inside a Pearl, right here on KBOO Portland.
Welcome to Bookwaves. I'm Richard Walensky. My guest is Edmund White, whose latest book is titled Inside a Pearl, My Years in Paris. Edmund White is the author of 25 earlier books, including City Boy, My Life in New York During the 60s and 70s, Jack Holmes and His Friend, which was the most recent novel, A Boy's Own Story, Farewell Symphony, many other books. Most of these novels are autobiographical, and the memoirs are, of course, autobiographical. Edmund White has, after writing all of the autobiographical novels, chose to write City Boy, which was a memoir about his years in New York, and then has followed it up now with his years in Paris, which began in 1983 and lasted pretty much to the end of the century.
Yeah, exactly. I think about 15, 16 years altogether.
You made a decision not to make it chronological, but to kind of let it wander almost in a Proustian way. Was that deliberate?
I wrote it when I was in the hospital, and I couldn't walk or talk, but I could still scribble, though nobody could read my writing. So it was fairly stream of consciousness, I guess, although I rewrote it quite a bit. It was edited more than any of my other books have been, and usually I just write one draft and that's it. But this one I rewrote several times, not so much to improve the language as to make it somewhat better structured.
You were in the hospital with a major stroke.
Yeah, I had a stroke and I couldn't walk or talk, and I was in rehab for a month. It was pretty grim, and I still walk with a cane, and I don't really have trouble talking, but somewhat.
But you have no trouble writing.
No, I mean, my stroke was in the pons, which controls things like swallowing and all kinds of things like that, but it doesn't affect your cognitive functions, or so we like to think.
When you were writing this book in the hospital and you were going through the various memories, did you have any notes to work with, or was this just off the top of your head at that point?
Yes, it was off the top of my head. I never keep diaries or notes, but now we live in the era of Google, so you can Google everybody and everything.
Inside of Pearl focuses on the relationship between how Americans think and French think, a little bit about the British. It seemed to me that more and more differences became clearer to you. What do you think is the biggest difference between how the two cultures think?
With regards to minority groups, for instance, and political correctness, they don't really believe much in political correctness. I mean, for instance, they would roll their eyes if you said you were a gay novelist or a black novelist or a Jewish novelist. They hate all those little categories.